You're listening to Robert Wright's Non-Zero Podcast.
Hi, Nikita.
Hey, Bob.
How are you doing?
Complicated question.
Well, we're gonna get into that and the sources of the complication. Let me introduce this. I'm Robert Wright, publisher of Non-Zero Newsletter and Substack. This is the Non-Zero Podcast. You're Nikita Petrov. You used to work with me at the Non-Zero Media Empire, but then you went off to found a media empire of your own. I know you're not a fan of Vladimir Putin, but one thing you share with him is your imperialist aspirations. And so your media empire is called Psychopolitica. It's a newsletter on Substack. People should check it out. It's unlike any other newsletter that I'm aware of. I think I can guarantee people that they'll agree after they check it out. And we are going to talk about Alexei Navalny from, I think, a pretty unusual perspective, or at least a perspective that you haven't exactly seen in the mainstream coverage of his death last week. So you lived in Russia until right after the invasion of Ukraine, you left. You're now in Spain. And you,
that's right,
you kind of came of age in the Navalny era in a way and were very influenced by it. You participated in political demonstrations that were Navalny-inspired, Navalny-related. You were even detained by police at one. We've told that story before, which is actually pretty entertaining on this podcast. Maybe we'll have time for it again. But I thought it would be good to just have you kind of tell the Navalny story from your perspective. How you became aware of him and kind of what he meant to your generation, and then talk a little about the aftermath, about what he was really trying to accomplish, what his legacy will be, and whether what he hoped to accomplish can be realized and so on. Does that all make sense?
Sure. Yeah. So I became aware of him pretty early on, like before he was, you know, considered the leader of the oppositional movement, before the most people thought there was an oppositional movement. I don't know exactly when that was, but by summer of 2011, this was like my first political event that I went to. There was this convention in this forest. There was a forest that they were building a highway through, and there was a protest against that, of cutting down the forest, and became for a short while a kind of focal point for just political anything in Russia. Like every once in a while you would get these protests. And
you're about how old at this point?
2011, that's, oh, God damn it, what year is it now?
I have a calculator here. I'll tell you what, you give me your birthday.
It's 12 years ago, so I'm 23. And Navalny, I think, is my age now. He's 35 or 34 at the time.
Uh-huh.
And so at the time he was like, if he was present somewhere in like some interview or somewhere, they would call him a blogger, because that was what he was known for. He was publishing at Live Journal, which was kind of like what Substack is now for, you know, in the West. At that time, Live Journal was for Russia. This is the blogosphere. And he was publishing these corruption investigations, detailed, you know, documents, how money gets stolen here and there. And he was presented, it's usually like lawyer/blogger, Alexei Navalny. And so I have a picture from that event where Navalny and me are sitting on the same lawn in the forest listening
really?
To somebody else. Yeah. With the kind of facial expression.
How close is he to you?
I'll show you the picture. It's like, I don't know, 5 meters or something. We're like, it was a small thing. He was not huge back then. He was like the most prominent person at the event, but there were no really prominent people at the event. And that actually was that particular event was fascinating, like looking back at it now, because it was a short period where the oppositional movement included every ideology. So in that forest gathered, you know, from feminists and like ultra-liberals and then neo-nationalists. And they all shared the same spot, and they had little, you know, there's a nationalist trying to deliver his speech, and the people who would never be caught in the same place with him, you know, before that are, you know, grilling him, why, you know, asking him questions and trying to prove him wrong. But they all shared the same pathos, which was, we can hash out the differences and figure out, you know, argue about the direction the country should go in after we achieve the ability to do so. Currently,
there are no... Is the idea that kind of active opponents of the regime, so to speak, were such a kind of, you know, minority that they just had to put aside their differences and collect their energies?
I mean, I don't exactly know why it happened that at that period, because, you know, there were a minority of, you know, oppositional figures before then. I guess they too also, you know, managed to, like the previous generation, Kasparov and Limonov, let's say, very different ideologically, but they would be arrested in the same square on the 31st of every second month. They had this strategy, it was called Strategy 31. They would do a protest on the 31st of every month that has a 31st. But those were tiny protests, usually, and they all just led to people getting arrested. And so the thing that you knew Kasparov and Limonov for is just pictures of them being dragged into a police van.
Okay.
And so Navalny was the first noticeable figure of the next generation of these oppositional politicians, and a very different kind. He actually had an ability to talk to different kinds of people and to deliver his message. He was constantly kind of innovating, figuring out new ways to reach more people or to tailor his message to different audiences. And he was trying to unite people of different stripes. Like at that time, the problem that people had with him, that I had with him, is this association with nationalists. He would attend grim looking rallies. There was this thing called Russian March, and he would go there, and there were people who, you know, you would definitely, some portion of the people at that march would do a Sieg Heil kind of salute.
Really? So there was kind of a neo-Nazi element. Not that he was directly necessarily associated with that, but he was at rallies, nationalist rallies that featured that element.
That's right. That it's like it was their territory, and he would go into that territory. And so at the time, there were a lot of arguments about that. I would have these long conversations with friends, and I would be the one who said, this is problematic, but let's try to figure out what he's doing here. And by now, I'm totally fine with that part of his biography, because I see what he was trying to do, I think. And it kind of lasted throughout the rest of his career, which is, he was kind of like a single issue candidate, which is he wants just the basic foundations of a democratic country. The separation of the branches of the government, open and honest elections, where, you know, any citizen can take the steps to be a part of the election. I mean, to run for some kind of office and not be, you can just ban people from running into election because they are independent actors. And no censorship. So, those are no government censorship. Those are the main kind of building blocks of what he was trying to achieve, and everything else was tied to that. So, you know, I guess also decentralization, but even decentralization of Russia. So like more mm-hmm. money and decision-making power should be given to regions on every level. So when he was running for mayor of Moscow, it was also part of the program that municipalities within Moscow should have more money and power than the center. That already is like a second order kind of thing. It's like a through line through his career, but that is already something that you can argue about after you establish a system where right. independent people can run for office, and there are debates where these people, you know, hash this out. So his main thing was that just establishing basic democratic right. infrastructure sort of for the country. And this nationalist thing, it's like at that time, there just was no movement. There was no group of people who had the passion or, you know, the strength or the conviction to like go and protest en masse. And the mm-hmm. nationalists were that kind of, you know, they had the potential of becoming that kind of power. And so he would talk to nationalists, he would talk to liberals, he would talk to whoever. If anybody is having a rally, he would try to be a part of it. And at the time, the nationalists were an important okay. force. And then after a while, he kind of drifted towards the liberal crowd more because they became more of the focal point of these protests. But his message stayed the same, and the thing that he was trying to do stayed the same. And it's just this basic reform to turn Russia into just a European democracy.
Mm-hmm. Okay. So you become aware of him as a blogger. I mean, he had kind of spent some time in more political circles, I guess, and for a time was even involved in what, you know, kind of, I think, more mainstream media, you might say, right? Like, I mean, I read in Wikipedia that for a time he was getting associated with state-run or state-approved TV or something. But anyway, he had a falling out.
I think he had, this is earlier, if I understand correctly what you're talking about, this is earlier than that. He was having these, he was hosting debates at a bar. This was before my time. He was hosting political debates at a bar. It was this like raunchy thing, like a cultural kind of event. And eventually somebody suggested to turn that into a TV show. And I think they've like made a pilot. I think maybe they had an okay. episode or two. So it wasn't like he had any sort of career. But I think they televised maybe one or two of these events. And they ended with Navalny shooting a guy in the leg. There was a neo-Nazi, actually.
Like, you mean a staged thing, or he actually shot him?
No, a bunch of neo-Nazis showed up to, wreak havoc, break tables and beat people up and whatnot. And Navalny had, it's not like a proper, I'm not good with guns. I don't know the different, kinds of guns that are out there. In Russian, it's called traumatichesky, like a traumatic gun. It's not like a proper gun, like
a pellet gun, maybe like a BB something. Gun or a pellet gun.
Yeah, so it's like what you can easily buy with current Russian laws. It's not as dangerous as I think it's like hard to kill a person with this, though possible.
Sounds like maybe a pellet gun. Okay,
and so he wounded this prominent neo-Nazi guy he shot him in a leg when the fight kind of broke out, and that was the end of his debates.
Okay, well, that's one way to bring a debate to an end. So then you become aware of him. He's like now a blogger, and I assume the whole blogosphere is a little freer than it is now.
Oh, for sure. I mean, mm-hmm. right now it's very, very tight. But at the time, yeah, you could publish, and he was like gaining prominence at this live journal blog of his, and I was a reader. And then 2011, so the summer of 2011, this convention in the forest, and then the autumn of 2011, the same people organized a different convention where I also was present, and the debate then was, we're going to have a parliamentary election at the end of the year in December. What are we going to do? Do we have a strategy or not? Because before then, there was never a strategy. There were like these politicians who, like systemic opposition, as it's called in Russia, people who are allowed to participate. And they would get 2%, 3%, 5%. And I think 5% was the threshold that like either gets you like a little bit of representation in the Duma, or you get funding. You get a little bit of state funding if you meet 5%. And that was a major hurdle. Like people couldn't mm-hmm. do that. And so, and they were like disparate. It was like this guy who never won anything says, go vote for me. And the other person who also is against Putin says, vote for me. And so there is no common strategy. And so Navalny was the person who came up with an approach that won a popular appeal within this, you know, pro-democratic movement.
He got above the 5% threshold.
No, he could not participate. Okay. It's not everybody can participate. And so the question was, what do we do if we can't actually like have a presence at the election? Like he can't run, he's not going to be allowed to. So what do we do? And his approach was vote for any party except for the United Russia. It doesn't matter. Like we're not going to be able to elect people we actually want to represent us. Mm-hmm. So let's just make a point of taking as many seats as we can from the ruling party so that then there's more competition in the parliament and maybe we can, you know, it's a showing of force and then we'll see what happens next. And maybe we can, you know, kind of shake the system up a little bit.
So find a party that is above the 5% threshold and support it just because it's not Putin's party.
The 5% is like, this is the goal for a minor party to show in the election. So it doesn't, like in his approach, it doesn't matter. Like you want to vote for maybe communists disgust you less than the liberals, or maybe liberals disgust you less than the communists.
Anybody,
whatever, but the United Russia. And that, so like in autumn, I remember this debate, it was him and two other people arguing for different strategies. So another was like boycott the election, and another was go to the polling station, but instead of putting a vote, just spoil the ballot, just mm-hmm. like cross it out or write a obscene word or whatever. And so Navalny's approach won, and for the first time there was a significant number of people, like a lot of people who never bothered to vote mm-hmm. did. Mm-hmm. And then some subset of those also registered to be the observers, I guess it's called, of the elections. That is, you register and you show up to the polling station to make sure that there is no fraud. Mm-hmm. And this is December 5th of 2011. And then these people who were the observers of the election, they recorded a whole lot of fraud. So a lot of people showed up and voted against the United Russia Party. And there was a lot of very straightforward fraud of like stuffing ballots in the ballots in the, you know, the voting urn, or stealing them and all that kind of stuff. And the results of the election that were officially presented the next day did not seem to make sense. And so to put the two into together, it was like, I remember the feeling. So we tried this thing. We had it like, we argued about the strategy, and then we had a strategy, then we went and voted. And then the next day you kind of get the message that it doesn't matter. We're just going to make up whatever numbers we want to. And you've got all this video proof of how exactly this happens. Mm-hmm. And so then, just like this election was a first for many, then there was a protest rally that was a first for many. And that was December.
You could disseminate video, like these observers had smartphones that documented this stuff or something. And then you, at this point, you could disseminate it on the internet. Like Putin kind of hadn't caught up to the the era.
Oh yeah, at that time the internet was free. They didn't really, and at that time it like felt maybe the internet is always going to be free because these people are not so good with technology. You know, they got their TV. They don't consider the internet as a major thing anyway.
Well, I remember conversations with you after this when you, when you explained to me, you know, the internet is kind of for young people and they're not paying that much attention to it. Most people watch mainstream TV and so Putin controls things through that. This was 10 years ago.
At that time, it's definitely, that was definitely the kind of predominant view. And Navalny was trying to use this tool and you know, I don't have TV, I'm going to use what I have. And so then I remember going to this party, that was this rally, and that was the first one for me. And I think my feeling was the same as most everybody's feeling at that event, which is we were very surprised to see each other. I thought I'm going to show up and it's going to be 300 people or whatever. It's going to be something small and insignificant. And it was 5,000 to 10,000, I think, is the number that they give. And at that time, that was like, wow, unheard of. And so there was this rally, and then Navalny and I guess Yashin were the two people. Yashin is in jail now as well. He's doing, I forget the sentence, but it's like definitely more than 6 years. And they decided to, they said, let's go to the election officials building. Yeah, I don't know the correct English terminology. You know, the people responsible for carrying out the elections and counting the results, and like protest in front of that building. And again, this was before kind of the rules were set. Like the limits of what you can do and can't do were not clear because nobody really did this before. There wasn't enough people that wanted to protest. And so at that time, yeah, let's go. We're not doing, you know, it's not illegal. We're just gonna go down a couple of streets and then show just a presence in front of this building. And this is where I got detained on our way to this building. And a lot of people got detained that day. And some got arrested. Like the group of people that I was grabbed with, like 30 people or whatever in the same police van, and we spent the night at the police station. The next day was court, and the sentences were given out seemingly at random. Like if you had prior history, you're definitely getting a sentence. And if not, there's just no logical reason. There's like, this guy gets 1,000 ruble fine. This guy gets 10 days in jail or prison or whatever the term is. And then the next week, there was a big legal registered rally at the Bolotnaya Square that at the time, at least, it seemed to me like it, a big part of the reason people showed up to that one is the arrests done at the first one. So it's like 5,000 to 10,000 people showed up right after the election. They got arrested. And then a week later, there is a totally legal, like you didn't know what was gonna happen. There was some fear, but I'm gonna skip, like there's so many details that I remember from that time, but there were reasons to believe that people are not gonna get arrested at this one.
Okay.
And so to that one, tens of thousands showed up, 50 or 70 or whatever. And that was completely unheard of. And so this was like the beginning of the era that ended a few years later. So the end of 2011 is this birth of the Russian protest movement, of whom Navalny was the main kind of character and eventually the leader. And then, like, you know, in 2012, people get first serious sentences, like 10 years in jail. And then 2013, Navalny runs for mayor of Moscow and shows a very strong result. Doesn't win, but shows a very strong result. And then 2014 is annexation of Crimea, and that changes the whole landscape because, like, these nationalists who were a part of the broader pro-democracy movement, some of them joined the authorities. It was very appealing to them that Russia is now...
So Putin wins over some of the nationalists who had been a problem for him by annexing Crimea.
That's right. He wins over some and he jails others and eventually kills some that were jailed.
And Navalny at this point supported the annexation of Crimea, right?
No, he did not. What gets him in trouble, the reason... I saw after he died, I saw some like angry comments from Ukrainians who were not happy with this guy getting praise. He didn't support the annexation of Crimea. What he said, the quote that gets him in trouble is the interviewer asked, like, so if you become the president, are you going to give Crimea back?
Mm-hmm.
And the quote is, Crimea is not a sandwich to just, you know, one person comes and takes it, the other person comes, gives it back. And his answer was, this is not going to be solved simply. This shouldn't have happened.
Mm-hmm.
But now that it has happened, it's going to become one of these territories like Northern Cyprus or something, where it's going to be disputed territory for a long time before we figure out how to put an end to this part of the history.
Okay. So is this whole period kind of before Navalny turns to YouTube as a big, it is.
Yeah. I don't remember when YouTube became a thing. I think the major push, the major push towards YouTube was like 2018, maybe, when he was, mm-hmm. he announced he's running for president,
mm-hmm.
Which I didn't. Even I didn't buy that. Like, you're not going to actually participate in the election. But he did this thing. Actually, I was listening to an interview with a guy in the aftermath of his death. People are remembering him. And I listened to an interview with this photographer, Evgeny Feldman, who was embedded with the campaign. He did an incredible job. Like, the pictures taken at that campaign, some of them are just incredible journalistic work. But he said that it never occurred to me. He said that he was covering the presidential election in the US in 2016. And then the Navalny people invited him to do like a little lecture and Q&A at their office about the presidential campaign in the US. Mm-hmm. And he thought, you know, they're just curious. And then Navalny announces his run, pretty shortly after that,
this is
2018 is the election, and I think 2017 is when he announced that he's running. That's never done in Russia. Nobody. So he ran like a U.S. style campaign where you start way ahead of the election and you go from one city to another city to another city and you do rallies and you talk to people and you do, you know, he can't do it quite the way Americans do it with like town halls and, you know, legally. But he did that where he could, and where he couldn't, he would gather people in the street and then the police shows up and they go, you got to disperse. And Navalny had this thing of negotiating with the police. So it's like, people have gathered. They were not allowed to, but they have. And so now there's this, and it's like some city in the middle of Russia where this kind of thing never happens. And so the police shows up, but they're not sure what to do. They go, you got to disperse. And Navalny goes, well, I already have all these people here. You don't want a commotion, do you? Like if I tell them go home, they're not going to go home and then it's going to be a whole thing. So how about we just do our thing? It's not going to take a long time and mm-hmm. we will be out of your hair. And sometimes they would actually just back away, and other times they wouldn't. And in that case, he would always escalate. which is to say he would like climb on a, you know, a pile of snow or a bench in a park, where at one point there's, I think, a picture of them. He's standing like on a what do you call it? It's a playground. What do you call it? A ride where a child would climb up and then
a slide.
Yeah. So Navalny is like on top of a, you know, slide in a playground, talking to people. Mm-hmm. This is after the police told him to disperse. And so he did that for like a year, I think. And apparently, this is what I'm saying, I never put the two and two together. Apparently, that's like inspired by, he was, you know, taking cues from how this is done in other countries. And he thought, well, maybe if I start early, and by the time election time comes, I actually have, you know, recognition, and I've done all these rallies, and there's reasons to think that you can't just easily dismiss me, maybe I can get into that election. That never happened. But yeah, so that's the timeline.
So just kind of to review, so from 2011 to 2014, when you have the Maidan revolution, and then Putin seizes Crimea and then annexes it, Navalny has succeeded in generating a kind of political mobilization that's, I guess, pretty much unprecedented. And he is kind of recognized as being the head of it. Is that by the end, I guess? I mean, it's kind of a Navalny thing.
I think it's probably like after the annexation of Crimea is when you could say that with more certainty, because what he was trying to do, let's say like 2011, 20, maybe 2013, when he runs for mayor of Moscow.
Okay.
is when you could say that this is clearly valid, because he is participating in an election. He has good results. He's like 30-something%, and the incumbent narrowly avoids the second tour of the second mm-hmm. round of voting. Even though he had all the resources, you know, all the billboards in the city and all the TV and all of that, and Navalny just had a couple of months of just doing these events. Every metro station in the city, he would like put up some chairs and talk to people. I don't know how many he did, like a couple of hundred or something.
So
of
Putin
these.
Must be a little freaked out at this point, like after the Moscow mayoral race.
I think that's right. So I think the idea was the reason, like, they didn't have to allow him to run in that election legally. Like there were bureaucratic barriers for him mm-hmm. to run, and they handed that to them. They like decided, go ahead. And I think the idea was that Sabyanin, who was the mayor then and is the mayor now, was popular, and he was changing the city, and you could see how the cheat city is becoming better. And so they thought he's gonna win with in a landslide, and so let's do this. Let's allow Navalny to run to prove that he's nobody. And that they failed at. He didn't win, but he proved that he's definitely not a nobody. Mm-hmm. And he had this huge, it was in the city, it was this huge thing. He's the only candidate who actually talked to people every day or like every second day. And he had volunteers. I was one of those people handing out newspapers and talking to people in the street. And he had events, and he had rallies, and there was this whole actual political campaign, which again just doesn't happen in Russia. Like all these parties that are there, you know, people who are running for president now, nobody's like talking to them. They're not talking to the people. They don't have a strategy of, because they are not trying to win. And he was trying to win, and he had this strong showing. And I think this is when they decided this is not gonna fly. We're gonna have to, and they just like gradually were tightening the screws
on the internet and the threshold for political participation and everything.
The changing the laws for elections, the political protests, you know, what's allowed, what's not allowed. Navalny himself, I'm not gonna remember the dates now, the years when he's like, there was a time when he's they start first criminal cases against him. And there was one time when they like gave him a sentence and then reversed that sentence after after a protest. And nobody really, I haven't heard like a very compelling explanation of what exactly happened there, because like it's like the judge gave him a sentence and then the next day they turn it around. It was weird. Navalny was asked about that and he said that, you know, I don't have any complicated explanations except so, you know, people went into the streets and protest and they decided this is too much of an outcry. But there are also conspiracy theories about, you know, maybe he had at the time, you know, somebody in the Kremlin who was kind of rooting for him and other people were not. There are, you know, different ideas, but no coherent explanation for that one. And then, you know, over the years, again, I don't remember the years now, but at some point his brother is put in jail for 2 years, I think. His brother who is not a figure of any sort. He's just Navalny's brother. Mm-hmm. And again, 2012, I said the first like long terms for regular protesters. So mm-hmm. it was another big rally at this Bolotnaya Square. And the people who were put in jail, it seemed like a random sample, like an old man, a woman, a young man, you know, people from different walks of life. It seemed like a tactic to like show whoever you are, if you attend, you're risking, you're taking the risk.
And then between 2014, 2018, it sounds like his path was still one of kind of political mobilization, political activism. He makes a big splash in the Moscow mayoral election. And is it then that he turns to a more purely kind of media strategy or a strategy more reliant on things like YouTube?
Well, it's just an evolution. Like, it's, again, as I said, he started out online.
Right.
You know, he had a blog.
Right.
And then he was just one of the first figures in sort of, you know, political or even journalistic circles in Russia to take YouTube seriously. He just realized that this is a tool that's going to make a difference.
I guess what I mean is after the mayor's election, does Putin kind of crack down enough that Navalny says, okay, for the time being, political office isn't going to be the thing. Demonstrations are going to be hard.
Demonstrations kept happening.
Okay.
They were just kind of some of them were bigger, some of them were smaller. The YouTube thing was a part of a broader strategy of which demonstrations were a part.
Right.
They had, I forget the year now, but one of the big successes was, you probably have seen this actually, at least like parts. He had this movie about like an investigative documentary sort about Medvedev. It was called "He's Not Demon to You," because people, yeah. It was like a quote from
who had been briefly president.
Had like one term. Yeah, one term
while
president.
Putin
between
stepped Putin's, back to be prime minister and then Putin reasserted his authority.
Yeah. And that kind of tanked Medvedev, actually. Like, he had a career before then, and after that, nobody took him seriously. And that thing...
So Navalny kind of finished him off politically, in a sense.
Yeah, yeah, you could say that. At least you could argue that. And that led to... I think that was the first time, if I'm not mistaken, I think this was the first time when the protests that Navalny's team were trying to organize were not local. So like the Bolotnaya rally, we're doing this in Moscow, and then other people, you know, did corresponding events in other cities, but there was no coherent strategy done, you know, by one mm-hmm. team of people to do a nationwide protests. And I think it was after that movie about Medvedev where they did this for the first time. And it was successful in terms of the number of people showing up. I was actually at that time, this was like, I was losing faith in in these protests. It seemed to me that 2011 to 2013, with the mayoral campaign as kind of the apex of that, there was a chance that these protests are going to matter, because the system has not fully adjusted to deal with them yet. And there was this, like, you know, he was able to actually participate in an election. And there was all this constant push and pull of what's allowed and what's not allowed. And people were trying to kind of expand those limits of what is allowed. And these protests were one part of it. And after, I think, you know, 2014, so it was like annexation of Crimea, there were anti-war protests. I was a part of that too. And I think at that time already, I was feeling like we're, you know, we showed up, but I don't think this is gonna, I don't think it has a chance of actually influencing the situation. And so I was, by the time Navalny was saying that he's running for president again, I was not buying that he's actually going to be on any ballot.
What year did he start saying he's running for president?
So the election is 2018, and I think 2017 must be the year when he announced the campaign and started going.
I got confused. I thought 2018 was the mayor's election. No,
that's 2013.
I'm sorry. Yeah, I got. Okay, so. Now, by this time, I actually know you, right? We're actually working together. So at this point, but do some people take him seriously? I mean, he does create a stir, surely, when he says, "I'm running for president."
For sure. And so this, the protest that I was talking about, where he, it was the first nationwide protest.
Mm-hmm.
The other thing that set it apart from others was that it was a younger crowd. So it's like, but you know, it must be like, I don't know, 5 years since my first rally.
Mm-hmm.
And so in those 5 years, you know, a bunch of school kids were not school kids anymore. You know, teenagers mm-hmm. got into their early 20s. And actually, it's like not the word, like, I think it was since that rally that Navalny, you know, his critics started mocking him for how young the crowd is, because some of them were still in high school or some of mm-hmm. them were like 18, 19. I think there was even a law passed against political propaganda to minors or something. Which is funny because yeah. Navalny doesn't really have access to these minors, and the ruling party has the schools, and they do propagandize in those schools mm-hmm. pretty openly. You know, you could see like posters for United Russia, and they, you know, kids are given notebooks and pens with political, you know, the logo of the political party and this kind of thing.
Mm-hmm. So by the time he says he's running for president, what would you say he kind of represents to people? I mean, has the nature of his cause evolved? He starts out as part of a pretty broad coalition that just isn't happy with the way things are done and wants things to, in one sense or another, open up. And does he have a more definite platform by the time he runs for president?
So he has a platform. We could look it up. I wouldn't be able to actually, mm-hmm. you know, articulate now the different points of it, but I'm pretty confident in saying this, that since, like, I started following him to his death, the different causes. So, like, I alluded to this in the beginning. Like, so one example of this was in the platform when he was running for president is decentralization.
Mm-hmm.
Right. So different regions should have different rules. More decisions should be made at the regional level. Chechnya is very different from Moscow. And, like, you know, what's allowed in the public, for example, might be different. It's, you know, like in the States, that one state might be different from the other. So he would, that was one part of the platform. But I think that was still secondary to just institutional reforms, you know, independent judiciary, no censorship, free and open elections, separation of the branches of the government. I forget if it was in that presidential platform of his, but later he articulated pretty strongly in, I think it was when he was in jail, he wrote this article that was published in some, like the New York Times or Washington Post, something like that, where he argued for parliamentary republic that became like a fully articulated opinion of his that Russia is considered a super presidential republic. So the balance of powers is shifted significantly towards, even before the, you know, Putin changed the constitution. Since 1993, it was considered like the balance of power is shifted towards the president pretty heavily. And Navalny made the argument, like, if you look at the fates of post-Soviet countries, those who became parliamentary republics are more prosperous and more free than those who chose a more presidential kind of approach. But in my mind, even that, again, I mean, it's a pretty fundamental thing. It's the kind of, like, if he comes to power, this is what he would try to do, these kinds of reforms. But I think more important, like, his, Navalny's followers, people who would vote for him in a presidential election, would not agree on this. You know, some people would think this is the right thing, some people would not. But that was a second order kind of position to what I've been describing. It's just, you can hear it even now. People say this, it's a very common thing to say, that all that we wanted and all of he represented is just to be a normal country. And normal just means a democracy of a European kind.
Okay. So after he runs for president, you know, after that, I'm kind of most aware of him as almost a YouTube figure. At some point, obviously, he becomes enough of, or he's perceived as enough of a threat to get poisoned. I guess that's in 2022. Maybe I've got that wrong.
No, that can't be. That must be 2020.
2020, he first gets poisoned.
I think so.
Okay. And that happens in Russia. So that's not long after he ran for president. Did he make enough of a showing such that the presidential run itself was a threat to Putin, or was it more things after that, or both?
No, the presidential run was important. It just wasn't really a presidential run, in my view, right? Mm-hmm. So he never had a chance of actually getting on a ballot.
Okay.
But he used the election as a reason to organize meetings with the people. So he would have these rallies where he would speak to the crowd. He would do Q&A. Somebody, some critic of his would show up, you know, a nationalist guy would show up and like criticize him, and he would go, okay, let's debate. And he would bring somebody on the stage and argue with them. And that, you know, the number of these meetings with local populations of all of these different cities, and the number of people who showed up, that definitely was not something that the Kremlin could tolerate. So they, you know, needed to do something. It's just people were slow to realize that they're going to actually try to kill him, and then eventually succeeded that.
And he's in Russia when he gets poisoned, right?
Mm-hmm. He's on this tour. It's 2020. I don't know what it was. What he must have been campaigning. There probably was a parliamentary election coming up, and he was doing the same kind of thing, touring the country. And he was in Siberia somewhere, I think in Murmansk, where this happened. He went into a coma, I guess, or whatever, like the thing that he started to feel bad on the plane.
So, right.
He was in midair. And then he landed in Murmansk, and this is where which is north This is where he was hospitalized, and for a while nobody could see him. And then there was a protest, and his wife showed up, and there were some pronouncements from foreign leaders. And eventually, after holding him there for a while, they allowed him to be transported to Germany, where he got better.
And then, you know, he makes his decision to come back to Russia, which amazed me at the time. I mean, he obviously was a courageous person. I mean, just the whole idea of even just being one of these people who keeps pushing things as far as they, you know, even getting up on the slide and delivering the speech if there are like police around looking menacing, yeah. You know, like that's not my style, you know?
Yeah.
Like, and you know, it's, I assume he was charismatic. I mean, he had like Hollywood good looks. He's this big, athletic looking, robust guy. He seems fearless. And I assume
he had a sense of humor that was a very important part of his appeal. Uh-huh. And he could talk to anybody. Like, all of these arrests, he would talk to the police that is arresting him, and sometimes, you know, manage to have a conversation where they seem, by the end of it, they seem like maybe, you know, if he gets on the ballot, they might actually vote for him. Just right now, they've got, you know, the situation is different. So yeah, he was a very, what is the word to use in English? Like coherent person. He was like the whole
articulate
thing.
Articulate,
like, I mean, there was no contradiction. He was like this one thing that he's doing, and he knows what he's doing, and he's going to do it until the end. And this is where this decision to come back comes from. It's like everybody's baffled, and he's always used to say, you know, it was not really a decision. For me to make, because the decision has been made way earlier.
What he means
is, you know, he made the decision to not think about the consequences for him a long time ago, right? Uh-huh. It's like, you know, by 2012, people who are interviewing him start the interview with, "Why are you still alive?" Right? So it was like by 2020. When he gets poisoned, it's like at least 8 years of him being very aware that he might get killed, and deciding to do this anyway. So it's a decision he made once, and then, you know, decided to not think about it, because if you think about it and you make this decision every day, then you might get paralyzed.
Yeah. It's amazing. And when he came back, did you think to yourself, well, he's definitely going to jail and he knows that much? Because he wasn't, at that point, I mean, did they have to drum up new charges? He hadn't been prosecuted. I mean, he wasn't facing jail time when he left, right?
No, I don't. I get confused because they had so many different cases against him.
He had periodically been, you know, they had tried to get him into various kinds of legal trouble, I think, going pretty far back, but...
And they had like a bunch of these cases. And so it's, at some point you kind of stop following, like, what is the new one?
Yeah, they're gonna dream up something in any event.
Yeah, it's not like it matters. It's not like it has to make legal sense or anything.
He must have guessed, I will almost certainly wind up in prison if I don't just get killed right away. I mean, if he's thinking, of course, you know, part of courage is being an optimist sometimes, you know.
I think that's, yeah, that's, it's a part of it. It's like, part of it is not thinking about the consequences. Let me try to not think about what happens when I do this. I know this is the right thing to do. Let me do that and see what happens. And then by that time, we kind of had this conversation, a similar conversation we talked about Prigozhin. You know, if for a while you take risks and you manage to survive, that's part of how you operate.
You can almost start to believe you lead a charmed life in a sense. I mean, I don't mean he was delusional or anything, but people, you keep getting positive reinforcement for something, and
I kind of, my feeling, I mean, this is you know, totally speculative and intuitive, but my feeling is he really, you know, he had this ethos of I'm going to do the right thing and let whatever happens after happen.
Yeah.
But what you're saying about this illusion of invincibility, I think a lot of people had this feeling about him. It seems, especially after, you know, he's poisoned and then he's in coma and then he gets out.
Yeah.
And he's, you know, in a few weeks, he looks healthy. And throughout this whole thing, even until his death, the last video that exists of him is the day before he dies. He's in court by video conference. So he's on a TV in court and there's a judge and then there's a prosecutor or somebody. And that video is him laughing with the judge and the prosecutor. He says something like, with all these decisions that you're making, dear judge, I'm running out of money, because he's like fined again and again and again. I'm running out of money, so I'm going to tell you my account number, my bank number. I mean, you should like crowdfund this initiative of me paying the fines that you're giving to me. And he kind of like, he says, out of your huge salary of a federal judge, and then chuckles. Uh-huh. And then the judge chuckles, the joke being the salary is not huge. Uh-huh. And, you know, part of Navalny's argument is judges should make more. And in a better system, if I were president, you actually would lead a better life. You would be respected because you would get a higher salary, and you would also have respect because people would know that you are trying to uphold justice and not, you know, fulfill the wishes of the higher-ups. But the point is, like, even until his death, he kept this optimistic, you know, attitude where everybody else is depressed. The photographer guy I was talking about earlier, he said that, I forget the details of his situation, but he kept writing, you know, exchanging letters with Navalny when he was in jail. And he said that Navalny got him out of depression at some point. And he's like, it's absurd. I'm free. I my life is fine, basically. And he's spending a third of his time in solitary confinement. And he's writing to me, cheer up. You know, you shouldn't put your hands down. You do what's necessary and, you know, don't wallow in despair. And he kept this attitude until the very end.
That's amazing. So listen, we have been talking close to an hour. And as you know, what we usually do now, I mean, traditionally, this is along our podcasts, we're roughly. Now we sometimes keep going into what we call overtime. That part is available to paid subscribers of the Non-Zero newsletter. We encourage everyone to become one. It's easy to do. In fact, there's a link in the show notes of the app. You can Google Non-Zero, and then you can set up a podcast feed. If you're a paid subscriber, that'll always have access to all the overtime and the various stuff that's behind the paywall, including the print stuff. Before we do that, I want to say again that people should, before we head into overtime, and thanks for sticking around for this part, Nikita, should tell people again to check out your newsletter, Psychopolitica. And do you have that picture handy to show people or should we wait? We can't just take a break and do it in overtime if you don't have it like within arm's reach.
You mean like find it and share my screen with you?
Yeah, I mean, screen share, that would work. I think I can do that.
I think I should be able to find it.
I mean,
it.
Screen share, I'll explain why you look for it, is problematic sometimes on as it translates into these videos.
I mean, I'm sure we can, you know, I can send it to you later.
Have you put it on your newsletter?
Oh, I actually put it on Twitter, but I found it. Let's see. Your screen. So, it says host disabled participant screen sharing.
Okay. Well, you can.
I can send it to you.
Send it to us, and we'll do something or other with it. So anyway, thanks to people who've stuck around for this long. I hope you'll join us in overtime.
Let me say just one more thing at the end, which is, so we've been talking about this as if the story is over, and maybe it is, but maybe it isn't. So the development since the death is his wife made a video saying, or widow, I should say, saying she's going to continue his work.
Right.
Which I don't know what that means. Today, I actually haven't had the time to read, but she made some kind of a speech. I don't even know where, but it's an address to the leaders of other countries. And I guess she's urging them to not recognize the presidential election that's going to happen in a month or so. I forget the date, but it's in March. And Navalny himself endorsed, it was not his idea, but he endorsed a strategy for legally and safely showing protest against Putin and his regime during the election. The election, I think, is the first one that's going to last 3 days instead of one. And the idea is that on the last day of the election, at noon, is when people who would like to vote against Putin but are not really able to do so will show up. So it's like, do whatever, you know, vote for a different candidate or spoil the ballot or steal the ballot or whatever. It's just show up at the polling station at noon on the last day of the election. It's not like you can arrest people for showing up at the presidential election, is the idea. Though, who knows? But he endorsed this approach, and so now there's like a month before the election, and I don't know what Yulia Navalny is going to try to do with this, but apparently she wants to try to do something, and so we're, you know, we'll see more news.
Okay.
I guess the last piece of news is she's now banned on Twitter or on X.
Oh, she's banned?
You wouldn't think that the speech... free speech proponent like
Elon Musk banned her on Twitter,
and she registered after his death. I don't think she had a Twitter account.
That's mind-blowing. Well, we can talk more about all this stuff in overtime, and, you know, how things look for the future and so on, but I gotta show people this picture. I've now got the picture of you and Navalny. I hope it shows up on Zoom, because it's such a great picture. I mean, I'll tell you what, we will make it show up on the screen. So if people are listening on the podcast, you can go to the YouTube channel. And by the way, as long as I'm making appeals to people watching on YouTube, if you click the like button, more people will watch this video. That's the way the YouTube algorithm works. I'm going to do a screen share here. And we'll, if this doesn't show up right, we'll just edit it in to the video. But there, so you can see that now, right, Nikita?
Yeah.
And you're right over, you're on the left. You're just beyond his right shoulder. You're like right there.
Yeah.
If I were you, I would have cropped out this guy on it over his left shoulder. I mean.
It's not my picture. You can see the copyright, you know, the photographer who took it. I don't know.
You didn't even like have this taken. You didn't like say,
No. This is
don't get a picture of me in the
vault. It's an event where there were photographers.
That's
at
amazing.
That time, you could. I mean, I've had many opportunities to like approach him and take a picture with him, as people did back then. Uh-huh. But for some reason, I never was the guy to do that with, like, you know, see a famous person, musician, or somebody, and try to take a picture. I probably should. Should start doing that, because people die.
Yeah, apparently. So here he seems to be wearing Converse All-Stars, which further endears him to me. Okay, so thanks to everybody. Now we're going to head into overtime.